I don't know how long it's taken us to get through Hebrews chapter 11 exactly. We're moving at a fairly good rate considering the richness of the subject matter and how easy it would be to get bogged down, especially with all these references to Old Testament individuals and their lives. And we're up to the 13th verse, Hebrews 11, verse number 13 tonight. And the section where we were had to do with the faith of the patriarchs and how these men, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph, all had something that tied them in together with regard to the promise, waiting, faith, waiting, in verse 8 to 20, if we're sticking with the outline, using the W's there. And they all were looking for something. All had to wait for something. I get to verse number 13. There's a kind of a parenthesis here from verse 13, 16, and then 17 and 18. Again, we looked at that last time because it deals with Abraham personally. But these statements in verse number 13 through 16 are kind of generalities. And the writer takes a break from Abraham just for a few verses to comment on some things than all the people he's been talking about, everybody he'd referenced up to this point, and those would start to follow too. They had a certain thing in common when it came to faith. And I titled this The Exclusiveness of Faith, or The Exclusivity of Faith. And these all died in faith, not having received the promises, verse 13 says, but having seen them afar off. Again, that looks back to Enoch, Sarah, Abraham, Noah, all the rest. But having seen them afar off and were persuaded of them and embraced them and confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. As far as the title, The Exclusiveness of Faith, is because, we are exclusive. Provincialism and parochialism and the idea that we're the only ones that have any truth at all, that's not good. But by the same token, we understand that we're people that are a minority in the world, and we don't fit in. We are strangers and pilgrims. Titus calls us, or Paul in the Epistle to Titus calls us peculiar people. And not everybody belongs to this. Jesus said, wide is the gate, and broad is the way that leads to destruction. Many there be which go in thereat, because straight is the gate, and narrow is the way which leads to life, and few there be that find it. So those who live by faith are kind of an exclusive crowd. If you like to be, one of those people that likes to be involved in all the exclusive things, go to the exclusive hotels and the exclusive cruises and exclusive memberships and exclusive clubs. Well, maybe you can't have all that, but you can have something that is very exclusive. The people of God. Of course, not everybody's clamoring to get in. Notwithstanding, you can feel awful special about it because you're only one of few. They died in faith, not having received the promises, but having seen them far off, were persuaded of them. The promise and the thing that they saw far off persuaded them. They were persuaded by it. It worked on them. It caused them to do things. And embraced them. And confessed that they're strangers and pilgrims on the earth. For they that say such things, declare plainly that they seek a country. And truly, if they had been mindful of that country from whence they came out, they might have had opportunity to have returned. But now, they desire a better country, that is, a heavenly. Wherefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he hath prepared for them a city. See, God isn't everybody's God. He's everybody's creator, but he's not everybody's God. And in the sense that he maybe is a God and that he has sovereign authority, over everything in his universe. But in terms of being covenantally related to God, the Jehovah, all capitals all the way across in the Old Testament. He's not that to everybody. He's the judge, the punisher, the Lord, in a dictatorial sense, but being in covenant with everybody, no, he's in covenant with those that are accepted in the beloved. And so it's the people of faith are an exclusive bunch. God is their God in a way that he's nobody else's God, and he's not even ashamed to be called your God. I mean, imagine that. If the devil asks him, are you his God? And God says, yep. Yeah, how can you be his God? Well, it's all covered, right? I don't see him. I see my son. That's all I can see. And that's the only way you can say any such thing as that. But that's by faith, isn't it? You know, the God, really, it has to be because we put faith in the finished work of Christ that God cannot be ashamed to be called our God. He says, look at all this stuff. Look at what he thinks. Look at how he acts. Look at how he looks himself in the mirror. You know, look, I mean, just look at him. He's a mess. He's awful. And God says, I don't see anything. You know, and that's how he cannot be ashamed, because he can't see all that stuff that would make him ashamed, because it's covered. See, that's imputation, our sins on Christ. He has made him to be sin for us and knew no sin, that we might be made, what, the righteousness of God in him. So, but it's exclusive. So you don't get to enjoy all that except for by faith. So the exclusiveness of faith. Now, with that heading in mind, verse number 13 tells me some other things that faith is excluded. And there's four or five things in here that faith is excluding. Faith leaves no room for complaint. You know, what does faith exclude? Well, faith excludes anybody that, first of all, the company, the household, the family of faith is an exclusive family. But faith, living by faith, means that some things are excluded from your life. And one of the things that's excluded from the life of faith is complaint. These all died in faith, not having received the promise. Or promises. But having seen them afar off and were persuaded of them, embraced them. And confess that they were disappointed and dissatisfied and felt like God had let them down. That's not what it says, is it? See, a life of faith leaves no room for complaint. Now you think about Abraham, Sarah, and Noah, Enoch, and so forth. They didn't really receive everything they desired. I mean, some of them received some of what they desired. Abraham got a son, but he didn't get his city. You know, I mean, none of them got everything that they desired. Some just saw what they desired and what God had promised at a distance, and that was enough. Moses didn't get to enter the promised land. He got to lead the Israelites out of Egypt, and he got to see it when God took him up on that mountain, but he didn't get to enter the promised land. Do you think that Moses desired to enter the promised land? You know, so you know what Moses did? He complained. Right?
God didn't let me in the promised land. All I did was make one stupid mistake, you know, and they pushed me into it anyway. It wasn't even my fault. They just made me do it. You know, all their bickering, griping, complaining, he'd done the same thing. Did Moses complain?
He didn't complain. So that's life. You know, you trust God and you don't get everything you want. Because that's just life. I mean, if you live by faith, you just trust God to take care of things, and things might go your way, they might not go your way. But it seems to me like faith is defined, one way we define it, is living as though possessing. Isn't it wonderful? Living as though possessing. I can live as though I possessed everything I wanted. I can be just as happy without everything I want as I would be if I had everything I wanted. Living as though possessing. Because people who have everything they want aren't happy. Most of the time. And the happiest people I know aren't people who in a sense they do have everything they want, but they don't have everything they could want. They found out, like Bill Howe said, the secret of happiness is not having what you want, it's wanting what you have. Right? Whatever it is that you have, make that what you want. The husband you have, the wife you have, the kids you have, the house you have, the church you have, whatever, you know. I mean, that's what I want. See, that's because the one I have is the one I want. So you know what, guys in here, you know how beauty is defined for you? Your wife, right? Everything is either ugly or beautiful in comparison to her. If it looks like her, it's good looking. If it doesn't, it's not. What is that? That's wanting what you have. That's in this case. Now, they had promises. So what did they want? Promises. Because that's what they had. And if they got what God promised to them, then they were happy. And if they didn't get what God promised to them, they were happy to have a promise. And somehow, for some reason, you know, the promise didn't come through for me, but it doesn't end with me, does it? There's the next generation, generation after that, generation after that. You understand, some of this stuff isn't fulfilled yet. You're still waiting for it. But did Abraham complain? I don't think so. See, living or dying in faith means to be under the rule of faith with the promises of God fixed in your mind. Spiritual vision doesn't depend on our ability to see God. It depends on our ability to trust God. And if trust is strong, then vision follows, and sometimes fulfillment comes. But it really never was about the receiving. It's always about the trusting. That's what God's trying to teach us. He's not trying to teach us to trust so we can receive. He's trying to teach us to trust so we can learn to trust. Because that's really where fulfillment comes from. So the exclusiveness of faith. Faith leaves no room for complaint. A person who is prone to complaining is not living by faith. Complaining people aren't living by faith. Be careful for nothing. But everything with prayer and supplication, let your requests be made known unto God. The peace of God, which passes all understanding, so keep your hearts and minds by Christ Jesus. Well, I don't know about this, and I don't like that, you know, and I'm just not so sure, and I'm fearful, and I'm worried. Well, you know, casting all your care upon Him, for He cares for you. Take no thought for the tomorrow shall take thought of things of itself. All that care, all that fretting, all that worrying, all that complaining, and they all go together, is unbelief. Faith leaves no room for complaint. Secondly, faith leaves no room for conformity to the world. Verse 13. These died in faith, not having received the promises, but having seen them far off, were persuaded to embrace them, confess that they were what? Strangers and pilgrims in the earth? For they that say such things declare plainly that they seek a country. What is that? That leaves no room for conformity to the world. If I'm declaring that I don't belong here. Let's just say I would never do this. For one thing, there's just no point in it at all anyway, but let's just say I bought season's tickets to the Bears games. Why would anybody do that? But let's just say I bought season tickets to go and watch the Bears play. And every time I went down there, I went dressed up like a Detroit Lion. I mean, every game I was there, and I was dressed up like a Lions fan. You know, I mean, I was silver and blue. You know, and just had Lion jerseys and Lion, you know, and Lion, you know, pennants and all that sort of thing, you know. And just, I mean, it didn't matter who the Bears were playing. They had to be playing the Lions. But I just went as a Lions fan. Now, you understand, I'd be declaring by that I sought a country. You know what I mean? I mean, I would be confessing that I was a stranger and a pilgrim in Chicago. Right? I mean, I like football, but I want to see the Lions. I don't. None of this is true, but just theoretically. You know, I love football, but I love the Lions, and I'll come down here and watch the Bears because the Bears are the only team in town, but I'd really rather be watching the Lions because I belong to Detroit and I belong to the Lions, which I don't, but again, for the sake of hypothetical argument. That's what Christians do. They go through Chicago when the Bulls have won 5 championships with a jersey on from another team. And so, man, don't you understand? We got the greatest basketball team in the history of the universe, you know. And I really honestly believe that, you know, with Scottie Pippen and Michael Jordan, that I think they could have won any game they really wanted to. I think every game they lost, they just didn't care about winning. If they really wanted it bad enough, I think they could have won every game they played if they wanted to. But I think they had to lose some just to keep some interest in them. You know, I mean, is it possible, you know? You know, so, I mean, if they just won every game, there wouldn't be any point in watching, would there? So they had to lose some. But I think it was the greatest basketball team in the history of the universe. I don't think it'll ever be able to anything compare to that again. However, I couldn't care less. You know what it means to me that much? You know, I got something a lot more interesting than that. I wasn't interested then. I'm certainly not interested now. Couldn't care less about the former glories of it. Didn't care about the glories of it when it was happening. Why? Because I seek a country. Why should I go? Who cares? You know, understand, in heaven, they yawn over that stuff. They wonder why you bring it up, if you did bring it up. You know, well, you know, Michael Jordan made 21 shots, you know. So what? You know, there's over here in Upper Slobovia someplace, you know, there's this pastor who's slugging it out, you know, trying to do a good work with some gypsies and some down and out people who lived under Soviet oppression, you know, and the guy's body's been, you know, 95 times. He's had bones broken in his body under the KGB. And that's something to be interested in. That's something to be interested in. So, that's interesting. How many points Michael Jordan scores in the game. That's not interesting. Not when you think about what really matters. But see, then that's because I don't belong to this country. To some extent, yeah, you know, some things are interesting, but whatever the world's all caught up in, I think we ought to run the opposite direction. Nate Saint, it was either Nate Saint or Jim Elliot, or probably both of them said it because they were good best friends. But one of them said first, and the other ones, both of them have been given credit for. But they said the spirit, the duty of every Christian is to discern the spirit of his age and to go diametrically opposed to it. There's those guys that were killed by those Aqua Indians down in Ecuador. Elizabeth Elliot's husband, not his best friend. John Phillips points out, he said the patriarchs were characterized by two objects. I'll tell you what they are, but let me get you to say, think about what two things really, really characterize a patriarch. If you can think of two things you were going to use, you couldn't draw a picture of any of the patriarchs. You were, like me, you couldn't draw faces at all. I can draw flies, but I don't take a bath. It's about the only thing I can really draw. But, you know, if I was going to just do kind of a simple line drawing, a sketch of something, two things that would symbolize a patriarch on a chart or on a poster. Two things. You know what they are? And I could draw either one of these. A tent and an altar. You know, you can just altar's a pile of stones. You know, that's it, building out of stones. And a tent, that's easy enough. I can even do that. But they, a tent and altar, that's what symbolizes the patriarchs. And with a tent, they confess their attitude towards this world. That was a confession. They never built a house. They never built a permanent dwelling. They lived in tents, sojourners. And with the tent, they would confess their attitude towards this world, that they would not let its attractions blind them to spiritual realities. And with the altar, I'm reading Phillips, they confess their relationship to the world to come. They were believers. The altar talked about the world that mattered, and the tent said, this one doesn't. I'm just passing through. They adopted the attitude that as far as this world was concerned, they were strangers away from home and pilgrims going home. And they that say such things declare plainly that they seek a country. They spoke out loud about their convictions about life on earth. Maybe not audibly, but their behavior, their tent, their altar. You understand, in the midst of that pagan, heathen world, they spoke out loud that they were strangers and aliens. Has anybody ever asked you, what planet are you from? I understand, you know, I'm educated enough to know that alien doesn't have to be from outer space. But I'm just saying that if you live for the Lord and you think like a Christian and you get in discussion with sometimes people, you know, that are just really into this world, you start telling them what you believe about things and how you live and what you believe about family and marriage and children and the future and heaven and you know, you say, I think, you know, when I get my resurrected body, I'm going to be risen. I'm going to go to the grave and I'm going to be raised from the dead, and I'm going to have a body made out of molten liquid gold, and I'm going to be able to fly at the speed of sound or at the speed of light in that body, you know, and what planet are you from? So, you know, the Bulls are winning the championship fifth time. They're going to get the fifth ring. I don't care. What planet are you from? What planet are you from? Well, I guess I'm an alien, huh? I can't say that I know for sure what planet I'm from, but I can say for sure that I'm an alien. I am an alien. You know? But faith can't remain silent. They declared, there in verse number 14, they declare plainly that they seek a country. How does your life say that? Does your life say, I plainly say to everybody who's looking at you, that you're looking for something else? Not that you're not satisfied, but you know that the thing that is really worth pursuing is not in this world anyway. It's not about what's down here. You can taste, touch, see, hear, and feel. That's not really what you're after. You might be able to enjoy it. We're here, you know, and we have the capacity for enjoying it. That's nice. But you know that that's not really where it is. It's not all about that. I mean, you know, don't. What I'm saying is this. I'd be a fool to tell you that you can't be godly unless you renounce all enjoyment of anything in the world. Because if you had to renounce all enjoyment of anything in this world, think of something you really hate to eat, and that's all you can eat. You can't eat anything you enjoy. You know, I mean, I would, if I was going to say you have to renounce all enjoyment of everything in this world, the only thing I could eat would be Brussels sprouts and liver. That's the rest of my life. I mean, otherwise, because why? Because, well, if I eat that steak, I enjoy it, see. And I can't do that. So, please, I'm not telling you that you can't enjoy anything in this world. If you can, you know, I enjoy the car I drive. I enjoy my motorcycle. I enjoy wearing a nice suit. I enjoy some other things in this world that are there, and it's legitimate to enjoy them. But I know that they're not where it's at. I don't seek that. If I can have it, that's nice. If I don't have it, that's okay too, because it's really not all about that. I eat some things that I don't really particularly like the taste of because I know they're good for me. And there's some things I really like the taste of I don't ever eat because I know they're really bad for me. And I used to be able to, you know, I used to be able to put away a whole 16-inch pizza at 11 o'clock at night without any problem. Now I don't dare do that. I almost die. I mean that. I almost die. I mean, I have acid reflux, you know, and I wake up in the middle of the night and my throat is contracted and I can't get air and I go around the trying to get, that's hard. I mean, it scares my wife. I think I'm going to die. I finally figured out how to do something, you know, I'm not talking about a whole 16-inch pizza. I'm just talking about a couple slices. You know, after 9 o'clock, I can't eat. I can't do that anymore. I could put the whole pizza away, but I don't. Why? Well, I weren't. But, you know, I enjoy a couple of pieces of pizza that I can have when I have them. You know, and I enjoy a lot of things. And you enjoy a lot of things, but you still have to declare by your life that it ain't down here. There's something really better and more enjoyable. More. If you can drive a car you like, drive one you like, why drive one that you hate? We're not Mennonites. We don't have to drive around in buggies and horses when everybody else has cars. We don't have to do it, but we still need to make sure that somehow the message is communicated. I can take it or leave it. You know, I can enjoy the having of it, but I can also be just fine without it, because really my stake is in something out of this world, not in this world. And faith can't remain silent. A couple of verses, look at Acts chapter 5, verse number 29. Declare plainly, declare plainly, declare plainly that they seek a country. Acts chapter 5. You know, I mean, it's a tendency among, you can tell when somebody's backslidden because they don't want to declare that they seek a country. They want their message of their life and their appearance and everything to be, I fit in down here. Chapter 5 and verse number 29 of Acts. Then Peter and the other apostles answered and said, we ought to obey God rather than men. They were told not to speak any more in this name, right? Verse 32. And the God of our fathers raised up Jesus, so forth. Verse 32. And we're as witnesses of these things, and so is also the Holy Ghost, whom God hath given to them that obey him. And look at Acts chapter 10 and verse number 39. Acts chapter 10 and verse number 39. And we are witnesses of all things which he did both in the land of the Jews and Jerusalem, whom they slew and hanged on trees. So we have to tell. We're witnesses of these things. We have to declare what we know. Faith cannot remain silent. It leaves no room for conformity to the world, because it's always saying, hey, wake up. Wake up. There's something more important than all this. Your life's a vapor. It appears for a little time, vanishes away. What shall it profit if you gain the whole world, lose your own soul? What are you going to give in exchange for your soul? Seek ye first the kingdom of God, his righteousness. See, we say that all the time. And we're supposed to say that all the time. Not just with our mouths, but with our lives. So, well, you know, you missed overtime. You could have worked. You could have made double time, but you went to church on Sunday. Yep. What do you do when you did? You declared you plainly. You declare plainly that you seek a country. When you miss making double time since you can go to church. I understand that every now and then somebody has to miss church for work. But I can't understand any Christian having a habit or just a policy of missing Sundays kind of just carelessly just because they have a chance to make a few bucks. I don't understand that. I understand if you're going to lose your job if you don't work the occasional Sunday. I understand that. The boss says, I only want you to do this two or three times a year, but I'll fire you if you don't. But at first, overtime, you know, and not even thinking about, well, I'm going to miss church for that overtime. And we're talking about two different things. You know, I mean, really, to be a legalist would say, quit your job, you know, let them fire you and not go into work. I wouldn't put that on anybody. But I don't understand a Christian who easily misses church just because he has a chance to put a few more bucks in his pocket. Why? Because you're no longer declaring plainly that you seek a country. You know, they get it. If you know, say, well, I got to take care of my family, you know, and I can miss a Sunday three times a year if the boss, you know, threatens me with my job over it. I guess, you know, they'll understand that. You can explain. I think any lost person would understand it. I really do. I think any lost person would get, you know, a guy's got to take care of his family, you know, and it's only three times a year. But I don't. But the lost person, when you try and tell him, you know, you're a dedicated Christian, and he sees you working every Sunday, you get a chance, you jump at it for the double time. Well, he's not going to take you seriously. You haven't really declared that you seek anything except for what's down here. That's what you're living for here. Faith leaves no room for conformity to the world. And then, you know, and there's lost people that won't work on Sunday just because that's their family day. You know, and you say God means more to you than their family means to them. But they won't give up a Sunday because they can be with their family. Faith leaves, verse 15, no room for compromise. And truly, if they had been mindful of that country from whence they came out, they might have had opportunity to have returned. Those who love the world always return to it. They always make their way back eventually. You know, Abraham wanted a wife for Isaac, and he didn't want one of the local girls. He wanted a girl from where he came from. But he didn't go back to get her. He sent one of his servants. We believe it to be Eleazar. But he sent a servant on that mission. I understand there's typology there, and I'm not dismissing the typology. But let's not forget that there can be a practical lesson in it, too. Eleazar, type of the Holy Ghost, seeking Rebekah, the bride of Christ, and, you know, Isaac staying up there with the Father. I understand all the types, but the fact of the matter is, Abraham didn't know he was portraying Christ in the church and the church age. Abraham just knew he didn't want to go back where he came from. For if they had been mindful of that country from whence they came out, they might have had opportunity to return. You see, it was imperative for Abraham that he show no signs, no open doors of opportunity for second-guessing about whether he made a mistake or not. You see, Abraham going back through the gate of the city, and somebody saying, oh, Abraham, have we got a proposition for you? So-and-so just dropped dead, you know, and we need somebody to do this job. We need somebody to run this business. Abraham, we know you understand this business. You know it inside and out. You were really prosperous at it. You've done well since you've left. You did well when you were here. We really believe you're the man for the job. Listen, I mean, we'll bring you and your family. We'll pay for your, you know, we'll send a U-Haul truck out there. We'll hire a rider to come and get you, or, you know, Mayflower or whatever. We'll send a moving company out there. We'll give you a $20,000 hiring bonus. You understand? I mean, you get a company car, you get the company, you get access to the company jet, you get membership in the country club, you get timeshare in the condo in Hawaii. Oh, come on, Abraham, just come back and work. But see, Eleazar, he had a job working for Abraham. And so there wasn't much risk to Eleazar to go back on a mission to seek a bride for Isaac, but there was a lot of risk to Abraham to go back in there, because he knows that it wasn't about Eleazar being out there, it was about Abraham being out there. Abraham's the one who had to be out there. Eleazar just had to be where Abraham was, but Abraham had to be out there, and Abraham said, I can't go back, because I might give myself an opportunity. If I go back to look, I might get myself an opportunity to go back permanent, and I don't want that. You know, somehow you have to burn certain bridges. Again, that's where faith comes in. You know, unbelief says, I got to make sure I got always a safe way to get back across. In case the battle doesn't go well over here. You know where the analogy of burning bridges, right? I don't remember which general it was. Anybody have to remember which Roman general it was? But there was a particularly risky campaign, and he knew his men were wavering. They weren't really sure about it. I don't know, it was probably Julius, might have been Augustus, but whoever it was, anyway, he took his armies across into a certain region, and then he had his engineers set the bridges on fire that the soldiers crossed over. So there was no turning back. They had to win now. If they didn't win, they're dead. And that idea of burning your bridges, you know, that's a metaphor, and we all understand vaguely what it means, but don't forget the way it got started as a figure of speech was based on somebody, they had two choices, win or die. They couldn't go back. And that's kind of what we need to do when we turn away from a life lived for selfish acquisition and materialism, and we go in faith for God, whatever the Lord wants. Faith leaves no room for compromise. You know, just like I had, at my mom's house, now, I didn't take them with me when I left there, but I had a pretty good collection of rock and roll records. I had some rare stuff. I had, like, Weasels Rip My Flesh and Burnt Weenie Sandwich and We're Only In It for the Money and Susie. I had all the weird Frank Zappa stuff, you know, that really weird psychedelic early Frank Zappa. I mean, that was hard to find. And I had some other, you know, strange and unusual records that were very difficult to find. I used to go around all the head shops down in College Park, in the University of Maryland there. I used to go in all the head shops trying to find these really rare, weird records. And I had quite a collection. And when I got saved, of course, you know, I went back. My mom let me come back and live in the house, and those records were still there. And I had them around for a while until finally some guy from, there was a singing group from Baptist Bible College, came through the church, and they one of the boys spent the night there at the house, and we were shooting pool in the basement, and he had gone through the records. Actually, I hadn't been to Chicago that week. I was here in Chicago helping a guy install a monorail system in a laundry, you know, industrial laundry down on the south side. That was interesting, but that's another story. But, and I'd been gone for 3 or 4 days, but I got back, and this guy was, you know, he was staying there. I can't remember his name, but he's just a preacher boy at Baptist Bible College. And we got talking about, you know, he wasn't even sure I was really saved, just like we talked about over here, you know. But, I convinced him, you know, that I'd really been saved. I just had a long way. He'd never seen anybody had as far to go as I had, you know, been saved. And we said, you know, boy, I noticed your records. I said, yeah, I'm kind of proud of some of that stuff. It was real hard to find. He said, you know, well, some of it's awful ungodly. I said, I know. I said, but, you know, it's irreplaceable. And if I ever backslide, I'd never be able to find them again. Yeah. You know, and he said, well, don't you think you're making it easier for yourself to backslide by keeping them? You know, you've got that window. You know, that's part of your whole identity, you know, from who you were before you were saved. You know, that was a big part of who you were. Everybody knew you like really weird things, you know, off the walls, because I just, that, you know, heavy acid head. And so you like that, and if you can get rid of that, so you're breaking that tie. Now, I never saw this verse in connection to that at the time, but that's what this verse is talking about. We took those records, threw them in the back of my mom's old Falcon station wagon, and took them over to a shopping center not far away, and threw them in the dumpster behind, I think it was a Safeway store, but, you know, it was a grocery store, and we threw them in the dumpster. I don't know what happened to them after that. I felt relieved they were gone. And yes, I had mixed feelings about it, but I knew it was the right thing to do, because I really didn't want to go back. I just didn't understand, you know, that it wasn't something you made provision for. I'm sure he gave me make no provision for the flesh, Romans 12. You know, to fulfill the lust thereof, put you on, Lord Jesus. I'm sure he didn't give me this verse. I know he didn't give me that verse. But that's what that verse is about. If they had been mindful of that country from whence they came out, they might have had opportunity to return. Saying, I got to keep it just in case I go back. No, you want to get rid of it because you don't want to go back. Faith leaves no room for compromise. Verse 16, faith leaves no room for comparison. But now they desire a better country. Better, better. No comparison. A better country. That is a heavenly. No comparison. Wherefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared for them a city. A home with God, in the city of God, with the approval of God. You understand? That's incomparable treasure. But those people, they saw them for the incomparable treasures they really were. And so there's no room for comparison. You know, all these things will I give thee if thou wilt fall down and worship me. Get thee behind me, Satan. Thou shalt worship the Lord thy God, and him only shalt thou serve. There's just no comparison. You say, well, how do you know that? By faith. I know something about the comparison between having God in my life and not having God in my life. I know something about the comparison of being completely out of control of myself and being under the control of the Holy Spirit of God. I know something about not being able to stop and being miserable in everything that I was doing and loathing myself when I finally woke up sometime the next day and looking in the mirror and thinking about what I'd done and trying to remember what I'd done, but remembering enough to despise myself for what I'd done. I remember that, see? And then I remember what it was like to feel fresh and clean and new and alive and right with God, you understand? There ain't no comparison. There's just no comparison. And no, I've not been to heaven yet. But I gotta say, if what I experience when I'm right with God is anything near heaven, ain't nothing to be compared between that and here. A taste of that here and all of this is better than all of this. And that, in comparison to the way it used to be, no comparison. You know, trying to think, there's a verse that's kind of skipping around the edge of my brain right now. But he that spared not his own son, but delivered him up for us all, how shall he not with him also freely give us all things? For I reckon that the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory which shall be revealed in us. For our light affliction, the end of the verse is, worketh in us a far more exceeding and eternal weight of glory. I don't remember. I can't get the verse started. But it worketh in us a far more exceeding and eternal weight of glory. Again, Paul compares this and that, and this and that, and this and that, several times. Almost every epistle, he does it somewhere. Some are more, you know, more memorable than others. But he's only this. Leave that alone. Don't go back to that. Faith leaves no room for complaint. If you have a call and a promise from God, you got nothing to complain about. You just have the privilege of having something from God. Faith leaves no room for conforming to the world. Let your life declare that you're a stranger and a pilgrim. Faith leaves no room for compromise. You can't get along with it because have no fellowship with the unfruitful works of darkness, but rather reprove them, for it's a shame. You even speak of those things which are done to them in secret. You're going to have to let it be known that you don't belong here, that you don't go along with it. And faith leaves no room for comparison. We know that what we have, only because God promised it to us, but we know that on the other side, when we wake up in another world, that is beyond anything that we can even imagine. And the best and the sweetest and the most beautiful thing ever you experience down here is not worthy to be compared with the glory that shall be revealed. And so faith accepts that. And that's why it's exclusive. Faith, only those who live by faith and walk by faith belong to this company. Everybody else is excluded. But faith excludes some things. It excludes complaint from your life. A person who's walking by faith doesn't complain. Faith excludes conforming to the world. Someone who's walking by faith doesn't want to be like the world. They got something better. Faith excludes compromise. You don't try to get along with the world. You try to be a light in the world. And faith leaves no room for comparison. So you can have it. I was in a beautiful home the other night. Becky Mitchell, you know, she babysits for this guy. Or actually, she's a nanny. And she's living in Nanny now. Magnificent, really, home. Gated community up in Barrington. I don't know how many thousand square foot, you know, four or five fireplaces, and just this mammoth house. And to tell you the truth, you know, it was kind of impressive, but I don't want it. I liked my house better when I got home. I honestly did. I mean, I'm not talking. I really prefer this to that. But, you know, going through, I'm thinking, you know, the Lord is preparing a mansion for me. You know, and why in the world should I care about all this? I guess it's nice, but to tell you the truth, I'd rather not have it. Got a Lamborghini in the garage. You know, it's amazing. Let me just keep you just for another couple minutes. This couple, they couldn't have any kids, and so they adopted three and got divorced. And now, half the time, the three adopted kids spend at her house. The other half of the time, they spend at his house. And she's got a nanny that takes care of them when they're at her house, and Becky takes care of them when they're at Bob's house. This guy's got so much money, he's going to install a lift in the garage so he can put one Lamborghini on top of the other. You know, one of those things where you drive the one Lamborghini into the lift goes up and you drive another Lamborghini because he's going to buy a second Lamborghini. And he's not happy. Not happy at all. And he's a miserable person. Why? Because, he thought he had it. Found out it wasn't there. And he doesn't know where else to look. And the one place where he could find it, it's not about that. Here's a room. Off to the side of, there's a ping pong table room up on the third floor. And there's a room off the side of that. And it's a very stark room. But in there he's got a couple of, he's got like a
a conch shell, and he burns incense in there. And basically, he's got like a little Buddhist prayer altar kind of a thing set up in that room. And, you know, every Thursday, he spends almost the entire day just up in there trying to find inner peace. In that one little stark room, it's about 8 feet wide and about 12 feet long. And it's just basically all it is just like an alcove for like a closet. I mean, it's not decorated, you know. I mean, it's just kind of, it's just very, almost like an attic kind of an atmosphere up there. But the walls are painted white. He's got a little rug on the floor, and he sits on that rug almost all day. And he likes the whole house. He's a massive house. But he likes to have a house to himself on Thursday, because that's his day just to try and seek inner peace in that room. He's never had the Lamborghini out of second gear. You know, just think how much peace he'd have if he got saved and sold that thing and gave it all to missions. Really, just think of the joy the guy could have, but he'll never have it. His mom is a graduate of Wheaton College. He's a guy a little bit older than me. He's in his mid-50s. His mom went to Wheaton College. Chances are his mom knows the gospel, you know, going back that far. But he's just completely clueless, lost in a fog. Anyway, that's enough. I've kept you too long. There's choir practice anyway. But boy, it's good to be in this exclusive company. I don't care about the world including me. I'm in something a lot better. All right, you're dismissed. The exclusiveness of faith.
I have a rare copy of my guitar wants to kill your mama.
Yeah.
That is impressive.